And this is the October the 10th edition of All Things Reconsidered. That's right, you've joined All Things Reconsidered for another weekend, and tonight we've got a wonderful show for you. This is going to be our 10th show, and as the gentleman who hosts this, I am very proud to say that we've stuck around for 10 shows. Hopefully we'll do another 100 or more. Tonight we've got Scott Ainslie with us, and Scott is a wonderful singer-songwriter and political activist from Vermont who is going to be sharing some time and some interviews with us. So, welcome. My name is Bruce Birch. You can reach us at www.thetruthis.us, and I'd like to welcome you to the show, so sit back, relax, and enjoy. I should say, with Scott Ainslie, and Scott is a singer-songwriter who that I ran into on the internet, basically talking, you know, going and looking for different political music. And Scott, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, but it's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you too. I saw that you've been doing music for a long time.
I started playing guitar in 1967. I was 15, and saw a local black gravedigger, a man named John Jackson, a great Piedmont East Coast blues guitarist and singer, play at a local high school. And I walked in there curious about folk music and walked out a guitar player who never touched the instrument.
So I saw that you had played a lot in North Carolina also. Are you from this part of the country? Or?
I lived in North Carolina for almost 20 years, raised my children there. I had two boys. I was a divorced dad. It scattered, and when they did, I came north again. So I live in southern Vermont now.
Okay, the blues I noticed that is a big part of your music. How did that shape your political beliefs at all? I mean, I noticed that you played a lot with some of the older African Americans in North Carolina and Virginia. You know, how did that shape your views today?
I did a lot of field work with older black players. These were mostly men, a few women born between 1900 and 1930. And it's profoundly moving to be with those folks. They've suffered more than I will probably ever suffer in my life and can come out of it, you know, generally happier and more upbeat and more sort of courageous. My political beliefs and my sort of outlook were formed a lot earlier. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia. In the 1960s, we arrived there as Kennedy was being elected president. So when I was 12, I watched his body roll down Constitution Avenue in front of me with, you know, 750,000 other people.
That must have been a very powerful experience.
And went to the Poor People's March on Washington and went to every May Day demonstration against the Vietnam War that I could make and marched on the Pentagon. And I grew up at a time in this country where you had to decide as you came to develop a conscience, which happened somewhere between, you know, 11 and 14, start to realize you're not the center of the universe. You had to decide whether you're going to be in front of the police dogs or behind them, whether you're going to be in front of the fire hoses or behind them. There was no middle ground. Police were beating up people, and then later during Kent State, the National Guard were shooting demonstrators in this country, and you just had to make a decision about, you know, whether you're going to be, you know, for the government or for the people, basically. At this point in my life, I'm 53 years old, just turned 53, and I guess with the new record, I wanted to have my say. I've been working with peace and justice issues since I was 14. Read Gandhi's autobiography when I was a 14-year-old kid. Dr. King was marching around our country, and all of my work with the blues and with African American culture and history has all been about balancing the scale a little bit in this country. The country that misperceives itself as a white Protestant country, it's actually a mixed race religious country, and so I do a lot on the African contributions to American culture. I do programs in the schools and in colleges, and the African roots of American music, and to the extent that there is political work on the new record, it falls right in line with all of my performance work. And musically, it's a little surprising because it's not blues to people who didn't know that I did other musics, but started out playing folk music and then fell into fiddle and banjo music, played old-time music with Tommy Jarrell and Al Creed and Fred Cockrum and the Hammonds family up in West Virginia. These are all icons in Southern traditional music. And then came back to blues and played, you know, and did a lot of field work with that. And I've just always been curious about a lot of different kinds of music, played lots of different kinds. So for the new records, it ain't blues, but it's cool.
Well, you know, I was very impressed with I could hear the blues in it. I mean, you know, when I listened to some of the cuts, you know, but actually, you know, I really appreciate what you're saying, because, you know, as I was reading your biography on the internet, I could see where the two tied together. It's good to hear from you exactly how you know, working with some of the artists that you worked with early on, and working with the kids in the schools, how your vision is sort of taking shape.
We have a hidden history in America. Typically, the high school textbooks certainly don't tell you anything about history. Is the only subject in America that you can study in high school. And when you get to college, you have to unlearn what you know. You know, if you study chemistry in high school, you learn the basics of chemistry. If you study biology, if you study French or English or math, and when you get to college, you're a leg up. If you study history in high school, you're a leg down. You're worse off than if you'd never heard anything about American culture. Because in high schools, the high school textbooks teach myths about America.
Yeah.
And they don't teach the truth. And so people grow up, and many people don't pursue any history in college. I didn't. And so when you start to learn the truth about what America has done, and not just the myths, then you realize that we're a country that has yet to really live up to the ideals that we all celebrate about the nation. If it's a government of and by and for the people, then we, the people, have to hold our government accountable to our ideals. Each government that comes in place, Democratic, Republican, doesn't matter. What matters is that when the government strays from our ideals, that we go to war to correct their course.
Yeah, and you know, I guess along those lines, it is really amazing to me that the Congress and, you know, or Senate, I should say, just passed a bill that included an anti-torture amendment written by, you know, a Vietnam veteran who experienced torture.
Senator John McCain.
Yeah.
Passed 90-9. I guess somebody abstained or wasn't present. This is the only bill that the president has threatened to veto. I mean, this is actually astonishing.
It is.
That he's going to... And it's a military appropriations bill that they've tucked this into. But more than that, that we have an administration in Washington that has fomented policies that lie outside the Geneva Convention. We have an attorney general who wrote memos in support of the president's ability to authorize torture and ghost detentions and, you know, outsourcing, extraordinary rendition, outsourcing prisoners and torture
mm-hmm.
to other countries. Absolutely astonishing. And it's what's kept the pot boiling in terms of the American public. Issues like this, the profound disregard for our values by the current administration, and they look right in the camera and lie. And, you know, we were looking for a smoking gun on Nixon and finally found one. We found one.
Yeah.
Well, this administration has been lying to the American public for 6 years.
It has.
Every journalist, every investigative journalist I know has a pile of stuff 4 feet high next to his desk, any one of which would have sunk Clinton, any one of which would have sunk Nixon. And the media is not laying a glove on this guy. We really have a huge disconnect between truth and what these men say. And in that gap between what they say and what they do is actually lethal, killing people.
Yes. Beside all that, there is stuff that's going on that we have no knowledge of. You know, and I don't want to sound too much like a conspiracy theorist, because I really am not. But, you know, if what we see and what we know, you know, is going on, imagine what we don't know.
Well, there are a number of really fine books. You have to read outside the box. You can't read the headlines. And,
sure.
And this makes learning about what's going on almost a luxury for people who don't have three jobs and haven't been driven into poverty by minimum wage. What's happened is the economic pressure on families is, first of all, it's destroying them because mom's not home, dad's not home, everybody's working, everybody's under a lot of economic pressure. And secondly, it's caused people to not have time to question what's going on. The who owns the media now is the question, which is why independent stations like yours and broadcasts, and people are saying, well, these guys don't represent me in the media. Exactly. These guys don't represent me in the government. We're going to start to take action. And but there's a great book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman by a guy who worked for the World Bank and set up through corrupt schemes, huge debt in the third world. And he wrote the book after 9/11 when people were saying, well, why do people hate us? You know, that question only lasted for about 45 milliseconds in the media and then was deep six. That is a very good question to ask. And this guy wrote this book because he said, I know why they hate us. I was there, I did it. The economic manipulation of political force and economic power in the third world so that we can build the resources, prohibit unions, trump local laws, and have our way in the world. It's economic imperialism.
Following that topic, too, you know, we now have Paul Wolfowitz, who is one of the war hawks at the Pentagon, in charge of the World Bank.
And Wolfowitz has been saying some very strange things, given who we know him to be. I'm talking about crusading to deal with world poverty, which was the World Bank's mission when it was set up. And he's talking like he wants to go back to do that. It's, when I hear that come out of Paul Wolfowitz's mouth, everything in my being goes off. Every you know, alarm I've got starts ringing. One doesn't know, you know, what's going on. And that's part of the problem. So ferreting that information out by reading books and newspaper articles, internet blogs, and trying to separate the nonsense from stuff that's like, well, there are a bunch of facts here that I've never heard of before.
Yeah.
I have a book in my hand by Cy Conn and Elizabeth Minnick. Cy is a great labor organizer and songwriter, of course, and in Charlotte, North Carolina, and works Grassroots Leadership Council, which is an organization he founded. The book's called The Fox and the Hen House. It's an advanced, uncorrected galley copy of it, and it's about a privatization that threatens democracy. One of the things he talks about in it is corporations and the politicians that support them, they support, are ensuring that public systems fail. And when Reagan came in and said, you know, that the government was the problem, people elected him because they expected him to fix government. They didn't expect him to destroy it.
Yeah.
What we have now are people who are out to destroy the federal government, to destroy public services, to privatize them, to take things that are rightly the government's role, that have to do with doing things that are not profitable economically, but that profit us as a people, the concept of a commonwealth. And they're taking the commonwealth, they're turning it into private wealth. There's a looting of the American tax base, a looting of the tax system. Government has never gotten smaller under Reagan, under Bush 1, under this Bush, gotten bigger, but it's shined its light away from the people who need it. It's thrown its benefits and treasure on people who don't.
Yeah, I saw an excellent editorial cartoon the other day that basically showed, the Democrats saying our way of fixing problems was to throw money at it, and the Republicans' way of fixing problems was to throw money at each other. But tell me about Don't Obey.
Well, Don't Obey began, I was reading one of Howard Zinn's wonderful books called Declarations of Independence, where he was sort of drawing a line between the accepted history of the country and the real history of the country. In it, he had a quote from C.P. Snow, who was a British essayist and scientist, science writer, and in writing about the Nazi officer corps, Snow wrote that when you survey the long and gloomy history of man, you come to realize that more hideous crimes have been committed in the name of obedience than in the name of rebellion. My mother and father would laugh, but being a rebellious sort, I closed the book instantly and thought, you know, God, that's my life.
Right.
As I say, I've been a Gandhian for a long time. Fired first to look into it by Dr. King's work in this country in the civil rights movement and the abuse against people of color who were asking for their rights. And the more I studied that, the more deeply I was involved in it. And so I wrote a song to lead you from obvious abuses that we can all sort of agree on, the less obvious abuses that are not generally agreed on, and show their similarities. And I wanted an anthem, frankly, for nonviolence and for personal conscience. The love of your country should never be used by someone else's. Love of your country should be used to build her country. Although when it's perverted from that, you know, I think it's evil.
Well, you know, it's a fantastic song. Let's go ahead and give it a listen.
Army, and with Stalin's awful crew, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Pearl Harbor too, across the sweep of human history, there's a truth they never tell, there's more horror in obedience than there'd be if we'd rebel. So when they speak to you of glory and colors bright and true, and using words like good and evil, say it all comes down to you. When they offer you a weapon and send you out, from Kent State to Denham Square, we cry out and we bleed. But from Tolstoy to Gandhi, from Gandhi to King, from Malcolm and Mandela and Biko to me, when they speak to you, colors bright and true, and using words like good and evil, I say it all comes down to you. When they offer you a weapon and send you out into the fray, don't obey, oh, don't obey. Those your loved ones huddled against that wall, can you hear the windows shatter, feel the buildings start to fall, something's gone wrong with us all, they're shooting in the hall. Exactly what they're asking, exactly what you do. How long would they stand there with their hands by their side, even all wrapped up in bunting, a lie is still a lie. So when they speak to you of glory, colors bright and true, and using words like good and evil, I say it all comes down to you. When they offer you a weapon, send you out.
Okay, Scott, the excellent song with Don't Obey. Tell me about Confession.
Confession is a song that was inspired by the killing of Stephen Biko and what triggered it. Biko was a sort of South Africa's Malcolm X. He was a very eloquent, wonderfully intelligent, terrific writer. A book of his writings that was smuggled out of his writings were smuggled out of South Africa in 1978, the year after he was killed by a man of the cloth who was close to Stephen and to the freedom movement,
okay.
The apartheid movement in South Africa. And Biko was, you know, the details of his killing are quite horrible and predictable in South Africa. But what triggered the song was five of the men who killed Biko, who actually held his arms and legs down and beat him, went before the South African Truth Commission. Desmond, and sat before Desmond Tutu and before Biko's family and confessed to his killing. And then, by telling the full story, then they would receive amnesty. It's a way of clearing the decks emotionally and historically in South Africa. So there's no question about the brutality of the apartheid regime, but there's also no question of the forgiveness of the country for itself. And they said, well, let's go on. The problem is, these guys sat down and said what they'd said in 1977. They said, well, he hit his head during an interrogation. And the Truth Commission, after some heartache and some questioning, getting nowhere with these Afrikaners who had done this, decided that they would not offer, accept their, quote, confession, because it wasn't confession at all.
Right.
And this set me to thinking about, you know, with the disappearances and the torture in South America and in Central America, all of which is, you know, our police forces and military folks who've been trained at the School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia, Fort Benning, at our government, our taxpayers' expense. That these guys are all go home to their wives and children every night, and they kiss them and chuck them up and talk to their parents and hang out, and then during the day they go out and destroy human lives and human psyches. If they don't actually kill, they inflict wounds that will never heal. They do this just, there's this tremendous split between who they love and who, and the people who are others. But there's one message by Performance Life, it's to get people to have a little more compassion for folks who are different. To generalize our compassion so that you wouldn't do the daughter of your neighbor what you wouldn't do to your own daughter, mm-hmm. that you would care for the daughter of a neighbor in the same way you would care for your own daughter.
You know, when I listened to it the first time, it brought me a chill, and then I read the lyrics, and which are available on your website at cattailmusic.com. I think what really got to me most of all was the disconnect between, you know, like you said, ruining people's lives 9 to 5 and then going home and having dinner and tucking the kids in at night and being all the typical life, you know, the concept is still the same. And I think that, you know, we have seen this play out in a number of situations. It's scary that we have John Negroponte as the head of the DIA, but...
you know, I wrote this song in 1997 after hearing offer their false confessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it knowing the details... some of the details of Biko's killing, and then sort of fictionalized it into a song, which is why Biko's name isn't attached to it necessarily,
right.
Nor is the country of South Africa. It's
okay.
A wide-open song.
Okay.
It's context.
Yeah, the context, it, you know, travels forth. And
But I pretty much wrote the song sort of pointing my finger at South America and, mm-hmm. and at Central America and at South Africa and at other countries in Africa as well, in Indonesia, places where Saudi Arabia, places where torture is routinely practiced. And then history caught up with me, and I suddenly realized that I was also pointing my finger at us. Abu Ghraib happened, and Alberto Gonzalez and George Bush happened, and Donald Rumsfeld. And we have written authorizations signed by the president to violate the Geneva Convention. A long laundry list of things, including waterboarding, tying prisoners to boards and submerging them in water so they think they're going to drown in order to incite terror in them, cause them to confess. Now, every military interrogator... every police interrogator will tell you that violence doesn't create confessions.
Right.
It creates compliance. So you don't get the truth out of people when you torture them. I mean, it's perfectly pointless. It's absolutely pointless. Unless what you want to do is, if it's centered around vengeance, you know, and inflicting pain and sadism, well, then that's torture. If you're torturing someone to get information out of them, you're going to get exactly what you want. You're not going to get the truth. So the song turned around and bit me after it was written. And part of the reason why I put the record out last year was because of what our country is doing.
Well, it's definitely a powerful song by Scott Ainsley. It's on his album, Feral Crow. This is Confession.
Mm-hmm. picked you up at your house, bound your wrists, taped your mouth, used our hands and our clubs. You weren't human to us. We drove home and kissed our wives, sang our children lullabies, joked with our parents on the phone. When we went to our cars, we went alone. Once learned, never forgotten. Once injured, ever scarred. Some people will change like the moon. Some are like stars. We threw you back in the van, combed our hair, washed our hands. We locked you inside, took you out for a ride. It started to rain. Your breathing was strange. For 500 miles, not going to try. Once learned, never forgotten. Once injured, ever scarred. Some people will change like the moon, some are like stars. And is it night, or is it day? Did you see them take me away? In our field, first light brings a chill. Nothing left to defend. The long night comes to an end. We are the makers of lies. Fathers, our children idolize. As patriots, we were the best. Now we come forward and confess. Once learned, never forgotten. Once injured, ever scarred. Some people will change like the moon. Some are like stars. Like stars.
and you're still listening to All Things Reconsidered. We're going to take a little break here from the interview with Mr. Ainslie. For those of you who are new to our show, that was Scott Ainslie, and Scott is a guest tonight, and you can reach him at cattailmusic.com. He has a great CD there for sale called Feral Crow, and he's he agreed to come on and be interviewed and talk about his album tonight. So just stay tuned for the second half of All Things Reconsidered, which will be up in about 30 seconds. Was a fantastic song, and I know that these were a couple of fairly biting songs, fairly strong. You also wrote a song called "It's My World Too." You went.
When I was living in New York, lived in Manhattan for 7 years, and when I was there, in the New York Times, there was an article on the closing of U.S. Steel in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It profiled workers who'd lost their job, and steel was a big deal in this country. A couple things happened after World War II. We, rebuilding Germany and Japan, we rebuilt their steel industries, which we bombed to smithereens, of course, and we built it with modern technology. So they had robotics and stuff. As they moved forward, they updated their technology, and they just could make steel more cheaply.
Sure.
It was being made in Pennsylvania because the steel plants there were built in the 1800s and hadn't really been updated very much.
Right.
Part of this is globalism, you know, globalization. Part of it is just a lack of responsibility of a corporate entity to the town that has made its money for it. And having watched GM shut down Detroit and you know, completely destroy that city, I read this one little paragraph about a guy who had worked in the mill, you know, for 17 years. He was 36 years old, had five kids, you know, four or five kids, four, I guess, in the song. The song tells the truth. and it was all gone. And what it means to have neighborhoods full of houses that nobody wants and you can't sell. And you know, it's the price of outsourcing work to another nation and getting goods at the cheapest price you can get them at. Rather than, you know, part of what our economy does is not just make money. It makes our country.
Sure.
It makes community.
Absolutely.
It makes lives. It supports families. Generates a sense of economic bonding and loyalty. And it profits us all. Not just the owners, not just the stockholders. It profits us all to have work to be done in this country. And that's really what the site's a meditation on, what it means to work and to lose that work.
Now, I noticed that you, on your website, you say that you first started writing the verses of the song in the early 80s. Is this another one that came back to bite you?
But yeah. I wrote this as a sort of a relic piece. Of course, this was right as Reagan was starting to disassemble the constraints on corporations. The laws that FDR had put in place, had helped put in place, anti-monopoly laws, laws against mergers, against the amassing of capital, were put in place in the 30s and the early 40s, and they were put there because FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, looked across the Atlantic at the development of fascism in Italy and Germany, and he looked at what made that possible. And what it made possible was the merger of industrialist corporations and the government. Mussolini himself wrote something to this effect, and this is very close to a quote, if it's not the exact words.
Okay.
He said that the form of government I invented shouldn't be called fascism, but corporatism, because it's a power, it's a merger of the powers of the corporation and the powers of the state. Now, American fascism isn't going to look like Italian fascism or German fascism. We're not going to see people marching around in the streets with torches and swastikas. Year 2000. What's going on now in this country is as close to fascism as anything that has ever happened. Because, as Cy Conn wrote in his book, the foxes, they're not just guarding the hen house. They appoints his friends, whether they're competent or not, as we saw with Michael Brown at FEMA. He was the college roommate of Bush's campaign manager.
Yeah.
That was his only qualification for that job. These people are ensuring that our public systems fail so they can say, well, see, government can't do anything right, and continue to destroy it. Grover Norquist said that he wanted to shrink the federal government down to the size where you could drown it in a bathtub. Fascism. The government is our protection, the protection of working people and normal people and all citizens in this country against the excesses and the abuses of the rich. My world, too, is just a peek at the underbelly of that, of people who live below the bottom line.
And, you know, just as an aside, I think it's amazing, you know, and we're going to listen to it, It's My World, Too, in a minute, but I wanted to also point this out, just along those lines of thinking, too, is that, you know, the president who was elected by this grand coalition of the right, you know, including the fundamentalist Christians and this whole, you know, this really a coalition of right-leaning groups, when he chose to appoint or nominate Supreme Court justices, instead of going with fundamentalist right, he went with the corporatist right. That's how our country's going to be influenced for the next 40 years.
Well, and this, the sad thing is that George Bush and the Republicans have used the Christian right. And, you know, I don't agree with fundamentalism in my book, in all its forms, is essentially looking backwards instead of looking forwards.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, it's a head-in-the-sand sort of attitude. And it creates misperceptions, it creates blindness, and it's a religion based on fear rather than based on love. Love, of course, requires that you open your eyes and engage the world courageously.
Mm-hmm. With hope.
And the Old Testament sort of preaching of the far right, it makes one wonder why they call themselves Christians at all, because the New Testament doesn't show up in any of their assertions. They're all about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, vengeance, a God of judgment, and there's no taking care of your neighbor in these guys. But anyway, Bush has used them, and the Republicans have used them to accomplish a corporate agenda, and that becomes clear, as you note, in the Supreme Court filling the vacancies here.
This is It's My World, Too.
I'm just 36, I got four little ones, been working here 17 years, setting rivets and welding and working the cranes. 17 years going straight down the drain, building a future that never came. Married straight out of high school, had me some fun. Come Monday, I guess she'll be gone. We built the United Nations and the Empire State, and the steel arch span over Mackinac Strait. But next week, they're locking the gate. Don't they know what they're doing? What we made, what they ruined. Don't they know it's my world too? Don't they know it's my world too? Newspapers leap and twirl down the street in a crazy kind of waltz. Husbands and wives toss and turn in their sleep. Their bridges are falling from under their feet. Who sows the seeds that we reap? Don't they know what they're doing? What we made, what they ruined. Don't they know it's my world too? Don't they know it's my world too? and your smokestacks have darkened the stars in our skies. And your foundry that blew sparks and soot in our eyes and looked like the 4th of July. Lights go out here about a quarter of nine. This old steel town is dying. All these houses for sale, and ain't none of them sold. My pockets are empty, my fingers are cold, and I'm so tired of doing what I'm told. I'm so tired of doing what I'm told. And your smokestacks have darkened the stars in our sky. And your foundry that blew sparks and soot in our eyes and looked like the 4th of July.
Well, you know, this has been a wonderful, wonderful conversation that we've had today, and I wanted to get over to a particular cut that is much more hopeful, perhaps, than some of the other songs, although the other songs have expressed exactly how a lot of us are feeling. Tell me about Rice Grows Again in Vietnam.
Yeah, I, of course, think that if you can get up and sing about it, you're ahead of the game. I mean, I've spent 25 years, 30 years playing blues, and you know, that's also characterized as a fairly hopeless and forlorn music. You know, loneliness, desperation, and heartache, and you can dance to it. that last little bit is, you know, that's a victory. If you can get up and sing about it, you're winning. So I find these other songs, while they're hard sometimes to listen to not be hopeless at all. But you know, the reason they exist and is about the human spirit.
Okay, and providing healing, yeah.
But Rice Grows Again in Vietnam is a song that I wrote actually from someone else's point of view. I wrote it from the point of view of a child. Tom Chapin, a good friend since 1980 when we worked together on Cotton Patch Gospel, a musical that his brother Harry wrote most of, almost all of it, and then died in the midst of our production, of mounting the production. He was killed in an auto accident. And Harry and I became very... Tom and I, excuse me, became very close friends in the course of doing the work, and have remained so. I co-wrote the title cut on his album, Common Ground, with him, and he produced my first record with me, Jealous of the Moon. And we've just been pals for a long time. So Tom called me at some point and said, you know, I said, what are you working on? He says, he's working on a kid's record of songs from around the world. And this was right after Robert McNamara had written a fairly thin apology for the Vietnam War. But he had apologized, which means that those of us who were in the Pentagon parking lot were right.
Okay.
Government was wrong. And I said, Tom, you know, you should write a song about Vietnam, you know, from a kid's point of view, what the war cost, just a little tune like that. You have music, you have scales from the Far East, from Asia in it. You know, he's going to use a didgeridoo for an Australian tune. He was going to, you know,
sure,
sounds from around the world, songs from around the world.
Sure.
And Tom, I could hear Tom's mouth fall open on the phone. The kid's record. I said, yeah, well, this would be great. You could do this. It would be very effective, very moving. You could look at the thing sort of innocently. It would be fun. And he said, political songs are really hard to write. And I said, well, you know, this is your moment in history, Tom. You know, we've got McNamara's apologized. You know, basically, we win. Tom said, tell you what, you write it and send it to me. And he didn't quite hang up the phone, but it was the bum's rush, you know, on the idea. And so, you know, when somebody smacks me with a glove like that, you know, I tend to go to work. So I rode around for a couple of weeks. I was doing a lot of driving and started to conceive of a way to approach a war, a disastrous war, for everyone involved, for the purveyors of violence and the victims of it. ever having confused the guilt of the men who do the fighting with the guilt of the men who send them there.
Right.
And always supporting the troops, you know, and the suffering. And you know, I was in the... When I meet Vietnam vets now and they ask me about the song, I say, you know, I fought this war here. I was trying to bring you boys home. And I haven't had anybody not thank me for that at this point. Not a rancor at the end of the war, but anyway. So I sat down and started to write a song from a child's point of view about Vietnam. That's where it came. The guitar part is, you know, sort of my sons, who are now 23 and 19, said, part of that sounds like Hendrix's guitar playing. You know, part of it does. There's little bits in the guitar part that are reminiscent of the decorations that Hendrix did on his more delicate pieces. And he was, of course, the guitarist for the war. He was Hendrix was the soundtrack for the war.
Sure.
A lot of the vets listen to that stuff. And I've had a lot of interaction with various Vietnamese musicians around this piece, and did finally, as the sort of the last thing we could get done on the tracks before we sent them off to be manufactured, was to find Duyen Tran, who is a 18-year-old Vietnamese girl, a neighbor of Jerry Murata, who was the drummer on the sessions. Jerry's a tremendous percussionist, and he adopted me on this project.
Okay.
Brought Duyen over to read the lyrics, which I had translated into Vietnamese. So the song is open to both language communities that suffered in this war. And while the Vietnamese is mixed back in the track a little bit, you know, it's clearly an English-dominant recording. It was very important to me that the song be open in that way. I've had quite a bit of reaction from Vietnam about it. And on iTunes now, my wife is the computer jockey in the family, and she... Barb Ackerman, and Barb said that, you know, on iTunes right now, Rice Grows Again in Vietnam is our number one download.
Wow. Well, it is a very powerful song. Let's go ahead and listen to that. This is Rice Grows Again in Vietnam. Again, this is from the album The Feral Crow, and this is Scott Ainslie. You can reach him at cattailmusic.com. This is Rice Grows Again in Vietnam.
Receive the strong, and prayers of ours for those who've gone. Forgive me for the wrongs I've done. Give me the strength to carry on. There will be days when rain will fall upon these fields, upon the wall.
remaining years. Lift up your tools, lay down your gun. Once peace is lost, nothing is won. Harvest a thousand grains from one. Rice grows again in Vietnam. There will be days when rain will fall upon these fields, upon the wall. But may the harvest of these tears bring peace to our remaining years. And though the war's pain is not gone, rice grows again in Vietnam.
All right, we've listened to a number of tunes today. This evening, Scott, and I just wanted to say thank you very much for coming on to the program. You know, is there anything that you would like to impart? Now, you've been around for 53 years. You were in the anti-war movement in the 60s. Did you participate recently in the September the 24th demonstration in Washington?
You know, I couldn't be there, but I noticed that 300,000 of my closest friends were there.
Yes.
And like all demonstrations, when you get 300,000 people who actually leave their lives on hold and go to Washington, D.C. or to a demonstration somewhere, probably they're carrying the good wishes of 20, 30, 40, 50 people in their communities who can't get away and be there. I was at the February 15th demonstrations just before the war started and the ramp up to the war when 15 million people around the world, went out.
Sure.
Stopped their lives to say, stop the war, don't do this. And as an old sort of silverback radical, my thoughts about this are that people need to, first of all, teenagers are always going to rebel. Really want to encourage that. Trying to stop it is foolish. We need their rebellion. We need their outrage. But we don't need it with ball caps turned sideways and pants down around their butts. We need them to take on world hunger. We need to take on the peace movement. We need to take on the disassembling of our democracy by the corporations. We need to take on a fair tax policy and economic justice in terms of wages that we pay. I mean, school teachers are working for 22 grand, 30 grand a year, and
yeah,
they're spending their own money to buy school supplies, and they're working 60-hour weeks. This isn't right in this country. But we need a little triage, and we need the energy of the young to do it, and we need the wisdom of people who've been around long enough to know the history. And when we put those two powers together, when you meld the outrage of young people, and that they're rightly outraged, and if you can keep that from turning into apathy and cynicism, then you've got a real victory on your hands. And that's what this work is about.
Well, this has been a wonderful, wonderful time to spend with you, Scott. And, I really hope that in the future we get a chance to do this again, because it's been very enlightening to me, and I'm sure also to my listeners.
We all have to put our cards on the table, because we can't really have a game until we have all of them there. Everybody has to put their hand on the wheel and give it a push. The famous quote is, all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. And of course, that was 19th century speaking. Good women.
Yes, absolutely. This is we've been talking tonight with Scott Ainslie. Scott is a blues guitarist and historian and political singer-songwriter. You can reach him at cattailmusic.com. Has a wonderful album out, Feral Crow, that you can buy online.
And Don't Obey is up there as a free MP3.
Okay.
And there's a great hunger for American dissent in the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is want.
And you've done a very good job of doing that, and I hope that tonight we've also done a very good job of doing that.
Thanks for the time, Bruce. It's good to talk to you.
It's great to talk with you, too. Have a Brady. And you have been listening to All Things Reconsidered. This is show number 10. I wanted to thank everyone for joining us tonight. We've been talking to Scott Ainslie, who is a wonderful singer-songwriter, political activist out of Vermont. Scott's going to be coming down to North Carolina in November. But if you get a chance to catch him out playing music, go and support this man. He's doing a great job and carrying a great message. You can reach him online at cattailmusic.com. Something else, you know, a couple other announcements that I wanted to make. Specifically, that we have a new archiving service. Ben Birch over at White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org, is now archiving our show. And you can get it there pretty much all the time, anytime, the day or night, 24/7, 24/8, if you prefer. And hopefully very soon we will be setting up a stream to shoot right through whiterosesociety.org so that we can offer you a link that you can always remember instead of having to change week to week. We are growing here at All Things Reconsidered. I'd like to also remind you that Peter Werby is coming up next. WRIF.com. He's got an interview tonight with David Sirota. And I'm grateful to be here with you tonight. Thank you much for joining us.
I think someday all these people who really are racist, they won't have anything to talk about any day, any